Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Jill Nephew. We're going to be talking about Jill's mission to harness technology to enhance human natural intelligence. And Jill is quite critical of large language models. She'll tell you why. I think it's a really important message. We're going to take a kind of meta view at our history and how we've come to view what intelligence is before zooming in on Jill's own journey around developing technology that can enhance human intelligence. Jill is the founder of Inquire, and the Inquire technology is designed to enhance and accelerate human sense-making abilities. And the designing of the system required her to attempt to answer a fundamental question, which is, how does technology interact with the mind's ability to do individual and collective sense-making? And what are the principles that technology should follow to maximize these abilities? So this is the broad area of our exploration today. And I think it's a very important conversation. So let's dive right in. Here's the podcast with Jill Nephew. Before we get into today's podcast, I'd like to take a moment to tell you about our new program, The Art of Developmental Coaching, which is enrolling now. It's the first time we've run this in 3 years, and we've made some big upgrades to this one. In preparation for this, I was reading the session descriptions and I got so excited about what you're going to learn in this program. It's based on a brilliant body of work created by a developmental psychologist, and it will teach you a superpower, and that's how to hear what's underneath your client's words to the meaning that they're making, so you can reveal the source of their challenges. It's as if you support them to see what their own mind was hiding from them, where they can unhook from long-standing patterns. Some of the other cool things you're going to learn in this program are the role of complexity in our evolution. It's a buzz topic in the field of coaching right now. We are in a complexity dojo, and you're going to learn how this is actually a good thing in that we can support our clients to evolve, harnessing the currents of complexity in their development. You're also going to learn something remarkable. We've got, I think, one of the world's leading pedagogies on practice design. This has been an area of challenge in my own coaching in the early years. How can we design developmentally appropriate practices which are personalized for our clients and their topics? Micro practices which build on top of each other so that they begin to inhabit a new way of being which helps them thrive. You'll also learn about one of the magic alchemical levers in development, polarities. Once you learn about polarities and how they're often at play in our own development, you'll see them everywhere with our clients, and you'll be able to harness that tension in service of your client's evolution. You're also going to learn about culture and how our individual development connects to the culture, whether that's the community culture or the organizational culture that we're in. And coaching specifically, that relationship, which is so potent. Lastly, you're going to learn practices that help you expand your state and attune to the relational field that we co-create with our clients. I also want to let you know that we have made your own development a priority in this program. It is the difference that makes a difference in the potency of your coaching, and it will support you to become the coach this moment is asking for. You will be invited to clarify your own developmental edge and use everything I've just described, all the tools and practices, to your own development. There will be specifically designed practices, questions, and inquiries you can engage with the cohort in this process. So it's a very potent learning container. And if you want to find out more, you can head to coachesrising.com/developmental coaching. Early bird is now open. Jill, so yes, I'm glad we're here. We were just saying in the check-in that, you know, we kind of connected about a year ago, I think, via Peter Lindbergh. And so, yeah, we've been intending to have a conversation. And in some ways, you actually said this, that I think the delay has actually been fortuitous in the sense of a lot is unfolding with AI and ChatGPT, these kind of platforms, and your work is really informative and enlightening around how humans can use technology to enhance learning. And I think you've got some beautiful thinking around that. So I'm glad we're here. Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited to have this conversation with you, which I'm sure you're going to get into because I think that the role of coaching is going to play such a critical piece in this. It's going to be really interesting to dig into like what the downstream effects of what's happening right now are with you. So, yeah.
We'll get into that. I want to ask you first, on your website, it actually describes you as someone who is thinking deeply about, how we can have technologies that enhance human intelligence, as opposed to distorting that or blocking it. And what's your sense of the possibilities with this? And that might lead us to also contrast that with what's occurring with large language models and ChatGPT. But could you tell us, in a sense, like what's your passion? Like what do you sense is possible as well?
Definitely. I think this might work best through a little bit of a narrative to talk about the origins of all this. So, great. So my backstory is that I came from being a super enthusiast of all personal growth and spiritual and everything technologies back in the 80s, 90s. Dove into my own spiritual tradition full on, have done the committed route, and also sampled widely. So I came from a base by of years and years of practice, and sampling and looking for something. And so early 90s, I stumbled on a format I really liked by a 94-year-old Quaker. That was nothing like I'd seen before. We can jump into the details of this, but I thought this is lightning in a bottle. This is a really important what's happening here. And she's doing very little to make it happen. And so I got to study that a little bit, and I thought there's like a protocol. My background was software and other things and systems. My academic background is physics, climate science, atmospheric science, biophysics. So I was a very science modeling oriented person, and even AI. I worked for 4 years at the AI research lab. So I'm listening for things that sound algorithmic. And actually, I listened to a podcast. I'm kind of segueing a little bit, but one of the earliest Buddhist Geeks podcasts I listened to, early 2000s, was with Shinzen Young, when he said he thought a lot of what he did was algorithmic. And I said, yeah, it is algorithmic. That's why we kind of compared it. That's why there's a documentary about a guru who just pretended to be one and became one. I forget what it's called, but it was this popular, someone can just imitate or ape these certain language and it does the spell on people. And then also you have these roles like meditation teachers, therapists, and whatnot that are also trying to maintain this neutrality, and it's not even a complex script. It's not like they're trying to razzle dazzle you. They're trying to actually intentionally erase things and come to this simple thing. So I had a lot of curiosity about, when you're listening as an engineer about anything that is algorithmic, meaning like you can just write down a recipe for it. Like that anyone can follow, even a child, like step-by-step instructions is what you're looking for. Like anybody can say, step one, say this, step two, say that. If you can find that thing, that is kind of the foundation of how we spread very easily, very powerful things within a culture. So this is kind of the fundamental of, especially when it's predictable, transparent, reproducible, and someone knows you're going to do this thing. So like yoga is a system of very reproducible algorithms of movement, and we're happy to sign up for things that, even if it's repetitive, we're happy to go through the movements, with somebody, and even just watch a video over and over again, or even listen to what some of our favorite meditation teachers do something similar over and over again, because we want help going through those movements. We want support going through a kind of movement of our attention. So I had that as a background, and I think I'll keep going with the narrative. What I experienced with the Quaker was a very I felt like it was the water I needed as an American, in our
Could you
culture.
say what that was that they didn't
Yeah, it
need
was.
to?
Yeah, exactly. So what happened was I got invited to a group that was my grandfather remarried, and his 82-year-old my new 82-year-old adopted grandmother, we resonated, and she invited me to this group that had been meeting for like 15 years. I was 30 at the time, so about 25 years ago. And I was the only person under 65 in this group for this weekend retreat that they did regularly with this Quaker they flew out to facilitate. And What happened was she was basically doing this very artful thing that we'll go into, like me trying to, over the years, to tease apart what was she actually doing. But the Quaker traditions are very interesting to study of how they manage minds and how they manage and support sense making. They have really cool technologies for this. So she was managing to do this thing that was able to pull out these deep threads of meaning from these ladies talking about their life and looking back on their life. That was one part. And the other part is that when you're dealing with people that are 60, 70, even up to 90 in the group, still trying to grow into things in their life. I was hearing stories of things that are happening when they're babies or when they're 11 or when they were 20. Like these are lifelong arcs of sense making into these things. And I started getting this long view of that this that I'd come from this very punishing therapy model that I had issues and I needed to like get on it and work it out before my reproductive years, or else I was going to pass on a basket case for a kid and should take a year and get a good therapist and work your shit out. It's like this really mean view. And now I'm dealing with literally one of the ladies was in Auschwitz, and she talks about the arc of her healing that she went on a journey of 30 years of hard work to get where she is now. And she said it was worth it. Her sister did none of that work, and everybody that knows both of them says you should do your work. So these are these really long arcs, and deep wisdom, and able to tell story through the way that the Quaker was facilitating this. That was giving me this really important view of this is what it is to be human. This is the human experience we're having here. These are people that I just cuss at in traffic or get out of my way in the grocery store. And now in this setting, what's being pulled out is like, I'm part of humanity here, and we're in Orange, we're in the center of LA, right? And like it is very unexotic, like hospital with a little beating room that smells musty with a bunch of old ladies from LA, talking about these massive arcs of what it's like to go through world wars, more than one, and or not more, one, more than one war, one world war, more than one war, and these really important arcs. And so I was like, there's no containers for these conversations. Like we need to be, that was the water. I felt like being with those ladies, I was up on this Mount Everest of perspective of what it means to be human in life that I was piecing together as like a landscape from their narratives. And that was happening in a container that was being facilitated very artfully, but very simply. And I thought, if I can spread this, this is what people need. This is my, I want other people to have this experience. And so there are lots of barriers to this, which I've been working through. So it bothered me for a number of years, I was on a solitary retreat for about 6 weeks in Turkey, just walking, writing, journaling, getting deep, and then emptying out. And I remember just it was there was nothing left but like, if you have to do this, I know you're terrified, but you have to just this is your work. You have to figure this out. So I quit my job shortly after, and began in 2009 trying to carefully tease through what does it take to disarm the bomb of modernity in American culture? What are all the barriers that are keeping these kind of things from happening, this kind of deep healing from happening, that is so built in to us? So it's more like a removing of a study of the removing of the barriers, understanding the factors. And then, like I said, then this weird piece that parts of it, if it's algorithmic, that means I can spread it. Like if I could put, her name is Perry Martin, worth remembering, she would be 100 and 20 now. And so I don't think she's around anymore, but if I could spread that around, that could really make a difference. So then the question is like how to do that. So that's been the puzzle I've been teasing apart. And then through that arc, a little bit more of the story is that I thought I would do it first just by sharing story and narrative. But what happened on the way to building that system? So I built a first version of a software system to help people do that. And then to do that I needed to really try to unpack the nature of that process, walking people through it with software, but the idea was I was trying to elicit something from people to share with others. That was my first model. Let me pull out your wisdom and give it to others. And that was the first thing I learned about, which we can go into. But there's a lot of things I've learned about. It may not be the most important one to talk about today. And so, you know, I first just thought that's what I'm doing. And then my early testers were telling me, and I had this experience as well, that this was therapeutic, which I did not intend to build a therapy machine. I intended to build something to help this problem. And so therapeutic that they're saying you should do this for therapy. And at that point, I was like, I don't want to be in that world. Like, I really don't want to compete with all the snake oil and all the stuff and all the, you know, I just knew it was going to be a really hard road. But my conscience was like, yeah, there's a lot you can do, even alone, somehow working with these forms that are asking you to like just get it out of yourself, just articulate these long threads of meaning and what happens when you just try to do that and only that. So that happened. And then one other little thing I'll nugget in, but then I'm going to pause. In my early testing, so what happened with the system that was surprising and amazing from an engineer perspective, from an engineer hat, was the first thing I needed to do was try to understand first, what is the nature of trying to elicit that from a mind? What do you have to get right and wrong? There's a lot of ways to do it wrong because we know about false memories. We know about getting people to commit confess to crimes they didn't commit. All that also can happen through inquiry. So there's a way to distort as you're pulling information out and steer people down garden paths, almost like control their cognitive workspace. So they see patterns that aren't real. And this is all very doable as well. So the idea was to try to find a certain kind of form that was, and we can go into that, but I think you speak to dimensions of this on your podcast with guests all the time, because I think coaches know this. There's almost a perceptual state you're getting people into. You're trying to get them to be in a perceiving state, not necessarily a thinking state, but a perceiving state against their model of reality, not the one you're giving them. So it's a little bit of like this, making sure you aren't, but there is an artfulness there. You can pull because, you know, you want to bring in things from their mind. So you can kind of play, almost like play notes on their mind to help their memory say, hey, maybe nudge, do you have anything over here? Do you have anything over there? And kind of help them with that. So where have you crossed over into liftoff, where you've given them a fantasy versus you're trying to help them play, you know, all these kind of different chords and notes of their own life to help them start to find workable new things. So that kind of form of thing, whatever you want to call that, inquiry, a lot of the words are too blunt because it's a very carefully constructed, you know, exercise you're doing. It's like you're almost being a doctor. It's very, you know, you're going into a psyche and you're being very specific, you know, when done well, to try to figure out how to get this thing together and even pick the right things. So the first, at the beginning, it was, well, how many kind of forms do this? And then this was like a year and a half of model building. And then realizing that as I was collecting these forms and trying to find them everywhere I could find them, just looking at what people had written, deconstructing things and curating this almost library of forms that I was running out of.
What do you mean by forms as well?
This kind of the form of the thing that does this, whatever that, you know, I'm kind of shorthanding that to form. So yeah. So whatever we're calling the if there's a pattern to how that's done, which we can go into, but the pattern of how that's done, I was trying to extract an algorithmic pattern of it. Is there a repeat thing you kind of say? Is there any repeat words is there anything that's repeating? So if you're model building, you kind of say, oh, you're kind of asking the same kind of, you know, use a question like how, what, why, where, when. Who figured out that those were the five we'd seem to be asking all the time, you know? So you could think of that as like an analogy of like, that's one style where you can say, oh, we're kind of asking who all the time, or I. So it turns out these things, to kind of jump to the punchline, exist in language. You can find them through language, through very careful language studies, that the way language works, a lot of the words are like 95% of what we're talking about today in conversation is only the first 1,000 words, which is really remarkable. So we orchestrate these same words over and over. So, and this is what we've realized with ChatGPT. Now everybody knows this, that you can orchestrate kind of frameworks of these common words and they'll create these kind of patterns. So it's, you're hunting for these kind of patterns, but of a specific kind.
Say what you mean by that again. So in the first 1,000 word, the part where you said in the first 1,000 words, we can elicit what, just unpack that a bit further.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so basically if you just were to write down a conversation and then do count the words, you know, like how many words are in that, and then you did it, you do a distribution of like how frequent are different words, like the word the, a, I think those are or at least the and a might be the most common ones, you know, then and what linguists call this is closed class words. So they're basically words where we're not going to make up another word for the. We're all, only always going to have one. And so there's this that kind of tells you that. So I actually did an exercise. If you want, anyone can look up what are the 50 most common words and just try to write a poem out of them, and you can. And it's kind of interesting. Like I call it closed class poetry. It's kind of fun to talk to say you're talking about everything and you're talking about nothing. So it's like kind of the framework of metaphor, the framework of there's a shape to thinking. So if you did that plotting, you would realize that by the time you looked at the frequent words, by the time you got to the 1,000th word, you would have covered 95% of everything said in an average conversation. So we aren't, yeah. So we only bring in these, we only sprinkle in the other 2 million or whatever, 5 million words we've made up. So, you know, we sprinkle them in because you can see my hands are doing it because most of what we're doing, we're talking is we have a referent in our mind's eye and we're walking around it and we're pointing at it and we're like bringing it and we have a perspective. So when I do this linguistically, you know, I'm talking about something over there. And so we're doing all this pointing in landscapes in each other's mind. We're in these spaces together. And that's what we're doing. We're operating on these simulations or I call emulations in each other's minds. And emulation is going to be a really important concept to come into. So I hope we get there. So I need to speed up a little here. So basically realizing there these form things, there wasn't infinitely many, that became kind of the backbone of and that they're all important. So when people are designing back to these forms, when people are designing very carefully in language, a way, like if you do a whole study on this, which is kind of again the backbone of how I spent most of my years of trying to extract out the not the other 2 million words, just the framework of the words that are the you could think of ways of looking, the ways of looking that someone might do themselves or have facilitated for them. There aren't infinitely many, but there's quite a lot. So by our count currently, and again, they still are coming in a little bit. It's one of these like kind of landing the plane things. We're at about 2,500 forms. And what that means over 15 years is that when we add a new form, it's because none of the other forms would have done quite the same job. And it's not that you need all 2,500 forms always. You have to, the right one will unlock something. And then what we do, which is interesting, is we learn how to cut into that set. We learn how to chunk it. So we know already you can remove a third because if you're talking past, present, future, you can split it in thirds. Now we've chunked it down. And then the way we linguistically frame things, if you study that, we're going to chunk it again and chunk it again. So you can kind of see how the mind is trying to find these things. And you also can see how the mind can get stuck and miss the important ones. Especially if you're bringing in a known framework. So kind of you could think of every psychological framework or coaching framework or business consulting framework can be articulated into a subset of these forms, any process for walking people through looking and seeing and facilitating that for people.
So there's so much in what you just shared. I think we could kind of pick up on, but I want to make
Yeah.
sure that I think we'll come back to these forms, but I want to make sure that right now we also that I just kind of give the listeners a clear sense of what we're intending with these forms. So what I'm hearing you say is there are these forms that you codified, you know, that there's an algorithm and that they unlock a certain way of learning, which is, you know, akin to what you were tapping in. You know, you saw this lady doing, you know, that inspired
Yeah.
you, and that it's
Yeah.
eliciting a kind of learning and,
Yes.
you know, growth of wisdom or healing. That's
Yeah.
really like great for humans to do, and that
Yeah.
you're codifying these forms over time, and that, you know, now you've got quite a lot of these forms, and that. And I think I just heard you say that you could fit maybe like coaching, some of the co common coaching styles or moves into forms
I
or
would
you
say
know,
that, yeah. Okay, so you could think of analogies. They could be thought of as forms. Sometimes we Think of them more as like patterns. And then at Inquire, we actually articulate them all the way down. That's my company, Inquire, into templates. So you literally, they're like a template that you have to learn how to work with them, but you can kind of fill in this framework, these templated things, and control different parts, all the guts of the form. And then you basically will generate a script that could be a starting point for, a child could read it and it'll work. And this is what we confirmed. Like anyone can read it and the will work. Even you could have an artificial voice read it and it'll work. But it can also be, but it's, you know, but the heavy lifting is finding the correct form and configuring it correctly, is having the context. So there's a big meaty middle, right? But then once at the end, what you've got what the barrier we're really excited to overcome is you've got something that will enable everybody to overcome if they've only learned like one framework. So kind of to clarify again, we claim that you could find that if there's a coaching form or a therapy form or a business consulting framework or anything that's using a form that's not in our system, we will put it in. So we're claiming an attempt to be comprehensive. Like this is how we built it, is basically we would take any framework and say, are we missing anything? Are they doing something there with the way they did that we're missing? And then we strip out the pattern and we put it into our system. We templatize it and we help make sure people can find it again within a context. So your mind can work through. I'm listening actively to a client. We have tools and can break this down and I can kind of see, here's a whole smorgasbord of these moves, And let me say one more thing that might be clarifying for the audience. The way we explain this a lot to help people understand what this is like is that, and this is how we experience these forms, is that if I was using visual as an analog and I said, I want to make sure you really understand your environment, I would tell you, you have to look up, down, left, right, front, and behind you. You cannot miss one. If you want to understand your environment, there's six and only six ways I need to tell you to look. And the brain does all the magic of the bleeding edge of that and interprets it and stitches it all together into a coherent whole. So you'd only have to kind of point a mind in a direction and it's smart and organic. We'll start pulling things in. But you can quite easily, if you're like, I learned a method and we just look forward, or I look at a method and it's about looking back, or we're about looking up. And you can actually, I've never done this before, I can actually think of analogous systems that actually are like that, right? Like looking up would be obviously the transcendent, and looking behind would be therapy, and looking forward would be coaching, and looking left and right might be social. Like, what are they doing? Like, what's around me? That you could, even that, you can kind of start to have a felt sense of like people will fall into modes that mirror a set of forms. And then the other dimension is how distance you're looking, which is really, that's construal, something called construal level theory. If you bring in the distancing part, if we're talking about, well, let's talk about 1,000 years in the future, or 1,000 years behind, or let's talk about today or yesterday. Like already you can use the same forms, but you're noticing you're changing this other dimension that feels really different. And when you get into long time horizons, or let's talk about everybody, let's just talk about me and my family. Let's talk, so you can go in these other dimensions that that start to take on different domains. Like spiritual is obviously long. Just claims long, and logistics is short and small, and strategy is somewhere in the middle, and balancing all of those, so it's making explicit kind of these, if you can make explicit what these simple ways to break down and chunk, that's that methodology, that make it kind of systematic, not as a do this, do this, do this in processes, but a control this dial, that dial, that dial, to help a coach or a therapist feel like, where am I not looking? Where do I need to help this person look? How can I deconstruct this problem so that I kind of know I'm exercising all the joints that can move around it, so I don't miss anything important? It's kind of the opening up of that. Yeah.
And I'm hearing there's a kind of contextualizing the learning in some way, or expanding the context. I want to do a thing where we jump to, I want to come, we're going to come back to this whole topic of like, what is learning in a sense? And
yes.
But I want to contrast it with a little bit of like what I've heard you talk about. And this also might segue us into AI and large language models for a while, which is like you said earlier in our conversation, you said, you know, there's a way that there are these barriers basically, and modernity has kind of, it sounded like within modernity there are some barriers. And so if, you know, and I've heard in some of your other conversations that you kind of, you've talked about what cognition is, how we could view what cognition is, as opposed to how it might be viewed now or how it might be being entrained in modernity. Could you kind of give us a sense of like, what are the barriers to our learning and to our sense of this arc of, you know, becoming more human that you talked about? What are the barriers and the barriers we find in modernity and what it's done to our cognition?
Right. That's exactly where I was hoping we'd go next. Yeah, that's awesome. We're tracking the same
Great.
thing. So for one thing, I have tried really hard to answer this question over the years. It's not the central thing I need to do. I'm building things, but I'm really also like, what's the trace of this? Why is this so pervasive? One thing I've noticed is that it's almost like I have yet to find a community that doesn't have a way of talking about it. So it's very all there's a thing that's very all pervasive in many ways that people talk about this thing. So I'll just pick one way to talk about the thing, but I could talk all day about these people see it as this way. So one really nice historical arc is the Renaissance when we made imagination. You know, there's lots of ways this story plays out. So basically, let me actually back up from there. Do you want people thinking for themselves or not? You know, if you want to enslave a human, you do not want them thinking for themselves. You want to stop a certain cognitive activity to control people. Like exploiting other people by controlling their minds has been around forever. And it is pretty much the only way to power is to get people to agree, because there's a lot more of them than you. In every power hierarchy, there's a lot more of them than you. And if you aren't managing their minds somehow to get them agree to keep you up there, this all falls apart. So everything going on right now is a giant, like, kind of damage control to keep people from having these abilities. So the biggest barrier is just the way power is arranged and the constant plugging of the holes to try to stop this stuff from happening. So 1300s, stoned to death, 1500s, burnt to the stake. If you look at, for instance, like the Art of Truth, which I don't want to, this one we could just rat hole on forever, but in the 1500s, when they're trying to spread this thing around, we got kind of origins, or at least one theory is we got the origins of the occult, because they had to encode everything. Because if you're caught having these things that could deconstruct people's thinking and have you realize the king's just a man and this is all just a system and a matrix I've agreed to, and feudalism doesn't have to be this way, I'm as qualified as anybody else. If you start, if they find out you have these things, you're dead, So at the end of one of Giordano Bruno's books, it's all written, it's just a book of codes and obfuscating and symbols. And at the end, he says, if the streets are running red with blood, flip the thing upside down. So it's like this thing of how do you encode and hide the fact that you're trying to wake up in this power system. So I think this speaks a lot to one of your recent guests. I'm blanking on the name, but he talked about, like, kind of, are you coaching into the world you want to exist, or are you just keeping the existing world going? That kind of that tension.
Yeah, I don't know if it was Peter Lindbergh or if it was Andy
Andy
Cahill,
Cahill.
maybe.
Yeah, it was Andy Cahill mentioned that. Yeah, I thought that was I was like, wow, that's it. So this is really baked into what we do, is we try to decide who thinks and who doesn't. And you could think of it in more grounded, now if you wanted to ground it, that was my long view. A short view, if you're just trying to run a business and you're like, look, I need you to do this delivery, you're like, well, why do we have trucks? Did you ever think about that? Like, what if you changed your business? We did all about bicycle. You're like, I need you to go right now and stop thinking. Like, I didn't hire you to think. Your job is to go drive that truck. Like, I will not be able to feed myself if you don't just do what I asked you to do. So there's like this little bit of this slotting of like, please don't think all the time. Don't question everything. So, it's not pure powers, doesn't have to be necessarily evil. Hierarchies don't necessarily have to be evil. But it is a power, it is an overpowering of like your brain might want to sprout out here, and I'm saying not now. this what we're doing here together will not work. And then how do you avoid that tension? Is obviously that by the time that happened, there was a failure of integration of a person seeing the same landscape. If your truck driver really understood the whole of what you're trying to get done, they wouldn't have done that anyway. But these things erupt where we're like, I don't understand the power structure I'm playing in, and I And I'm trying to like make it, I'm trying to understand it. I'm trying to make it organic. I'm trying to understand how it sits in the world. And so basically, that's how kind of that's the biggest barrier. I think you could say the biggest barrier is that there aren't enough containers for this kind of thinking. But I'd say the kind of upstream of that is that we have all this kind of cultural debt in that people don't really understand the systems they participate in. And if they did, they'd be, as we know, deeper and deeper layers of horrification and frustration and powerlessness to understand how we seem to have this uncontrolled machine that's running all of us that we're all kind of entrained into, that's kind of going on autopilot, digesting our life support system.
The machine you're referring to, is that the power structures? What is that?
Like basically no one person controls the power so much anymore. It's these networks of power. And if you think about what animates all that power, a lot of it is just like quite literally pumped out of the ground. You know, we get all this free energy and it just runs through these literal machines. Like the oil in the ground runs machines. The human organic non-machine, which is us, we are not machines. We are getting entrained into the gears of this machine is being torn up, and no individual person knows how to like dismantle all this machinery. And then when we vilify people at the heads of the machine, with you know, I'm sure if you got into their inner world, you'd realize they're as helpless in this web of power networks, and you know, they can't suddenly make some move. It doesn't work like that in their world either. Like nobody can get out, you know. So there has to be this collective process going on. It has to happen in the relationship between people. So that's one of the biggest of lifting out. And then you realize, because otherwise, if one person kind of wakes up to the machine, it's like now you're just even more sad as you're being ground to bits, you know, because you're realizing everybody else is too. So at some point, we need to lift out and find each other, you know, and create a different network of meaning and understanding that can step out from that power structure.
I mean, I'm just interrupting you, but I think people listening would feel like, oh, that could be what's happening now as well, I mean, it may be that there are ways, like with, that machine is kind of trying to entrench even more deeply. But at the same time, it seems like there is, like, people talk about time between worlds, or that a rupture of modernity. And so so I'm hearing you say, like, the way the world has formed, society's formed, has kind of codified our thinking, that and maybe corrupted the way we think in particular directions. And maybe, and I've heard you talk about ungrounded and kind of like the disconnected thinking.
Yeah, right on. Yeah. So that's the right direction. Yeah. So you could think of it like, and again, I'm trying to de personalize and de romanticize this, but the idea that in order to be functional in a machine world, we need to operate in a certain way that is, if the machine's what feeds us, which 99.99%, except for the ones that may pulled off back to the land a little bit, you know, the rest of us, like if we plug for the machine, we just die. Like somehow some network of power is feeding us that we're participating and we're doing jobs, we're showing up, we're participating in these systems to live. And so to be consistent with and be able to think in those systems, be successful in those systems, we need to think in a way that's consistent with those systems. And that's where you see everywhere from the academy down, you took over physics, it took over everywhere. The way even people think as scientists are bound, there's pressure to think in terms of what I call closed systems. So a great kind of thread of this one is physics. When they split the atom, it became about engineering and calculating, computing, to shut up and compute, versus natural philosophy, which was part of its lineage before that, which was that we can know more than we can articulate. We can know more than we can calculate. We can know more than we can put into mathematical forms. And we can discuss that, and we can articulate that through language, and we can try to understand the natural world, the world around us, the physical natural world around us, and we can even talk about even deeper than that. We can even legitimize our direct experience, which is a whole nother move to talk about that got intentionally delegitimized, not surprisingly, so that we would only deal with objective third person perspective, objective, unbiased. The only thing that can be objective and biased is a machine. You know, if you want to know what's really, and we'll get into this, but if you want to understand a living system, you have to take a point of reference. You have to go to experience. There's no way out of it. Like that's how it works. And we'll talk about that in a bit. So we've been, so basically to try to summarize this, without us realizing it, we have rewarded, we have cultivated, we've set up IQ tests and structures and thoughts about what learning is and teaching is and maturity is and all these things through this lens of being compatible with interacting with closed systems. A machine is a closed system. It's got closed walls. It works the same way every time. Nature's an open system. Nature is an ongoing relationship. It's ecological. It's sometimes things happen that are somewhat reproducible. We get a feel for it. We have to sense into it. You know, we have to sense into what's a storm's coming. We need to sense into all the timelines of the different plants and animals around us. What are they communicating? We're sensing into all this dynamic surrounding, you know, constantly. If we're embedded in a natural system, we are saturated with sensing our environment to understand our place and continually negotiate in an open system. Because we don't have the energy to close ourselves off, we'll die. We have to stay open so that we're operating now our natural intelligence, the way every living system is, what we're designed to do is to be continually sensing into a dynamic environment and doing incredibly complex ability to overlay on overlay, you know, these systems. I know what the earth is doing. I know what the plants are doing, what the animals are doing, and the wind is doing. I know what all these things, and my friends and my relationships and my kids, and you're just doing it. Your brain's just doing it. How? Now, if we go to back to what, you know, this closed system, if you try to model that in a closed system, everything a naturally intelligent system does, just think about that tracking. You're foraging, you're hunting, you're, you know, raising kids, you're thinking about the future, you're having an argument, you're talking, all that's going on. To contain that in a closed system as a simulation, everyone knows that's intractable. That's impossible. And it's different for each perspective because each perspective has a different deep history. Each perspective interprets it through their history. So now you have an accumulation of lived wisdom that was also passed on all the way down, potentially billion, half a billion years, one way or another, passed on understanding that we get from our context of our, you know, lineages and then grow into what's going on now. So all this is like, very, and then we coordinate with each other, and then the other incredibly powerful thing we do through language is we're able to emulate each other, and that's insane, like how powerful that is. Not simulate, emulate.
When you say emulate, what do you mean by that word?
Yeah. So what that means, and this is like a super. When I found this paper recently that made this very clear, a 2007 paper, Cognitive Science, I was like, that's the frame the world needs to know about with the AI. I'll start with a simple way to understand it. If you want to do a simulation of something, like I want to simulate SimCity, you know, I create like, you know, a version, a model of everything, and I say the next thing that happens is going to look somewhat needs to look somewhat like the last thing. And if I have some good equations and stuff and somewhat rough idea how the world works, I can kind of run a simulation and it runs forward and it looks like the real world. So that's a simulation. So simulation, you start with a picture of everything fully defined, and then you run it forward. Now, emulation is different. And emulation means that I take the whole system from which reality and things come forth, are grown out of, emerge is kind of the word that people can relate to. Like, I'm going to take the medium of which things emerge, and I'm going to take that whole kind of thing, that heart, that hardware, that organism that things emerge from, a mind, a brain, the exact physical embodiment of the thing that it emerges from. And when I do an emulation, I have to have the exact, that whole thing has to work the same way. And I don't put in the same kind of thing. I don't put in, here's SimCity, here's the blocks, here's the people, here's the walls. I put in different things for to run an emulation. So an emulation, I can say, imagine you're in, you know, your favorite spot in your house, you know, and you're drinking your favorite drink, and you're reclining, you know, now you're reclining on the floor in the closest spot on the floor and the ground. And so I'm running an emulation, and I don't have to be specific. I couldn't run that as a simulation unless I said, now tell me what color the carpet is, what the room looks like, what you're drinking, because I need to put all that into a simulator so that it can say, okay, I've got all the physics and everything. Now I know if your cup's here, you're about ready to go like that, and I'll run the simulation. But if I say, you're feeling thirsty, and it's like, emulate, you're like, I'm feeling thirsty. This is how I drink water. This is how I drink my water. It's like you, and now you realize that as emulators, what we're doing and what we can do very powerfully, like, how do we know we can do this for each other? How do I know I can emulate you or someone else with incredible power? It's theater, that we can be an actor. And what we do is we carefully trace back all the important parts, a method actor, right? All important dimensions that fill in a character. What are their motivation? What's their story? You know, what's happening in the scene? We start to fill in all these loose things that are all accompanying the script, but not. And then we get an actor to run all those thought experiments and bring all those things into their mind and start looking through the eyes of that character and start filling in a consistent landscape of what it's like to be that character. And now we find that like evocative, believable, powerful, and we experience it in very similar ways. So we kind of when we see a drama, we all know who the villain is and why. Like, an actor conveys a successful embodiment of a human, and we interpret that embodiment in a consistent way. I'm not sure if that was a little too abstract, but I'm kind of giving the common sense justification of how we know we can powerfully emulate for each other.
Well, let me ask this first, and because I've got so many questions, like this is like incredible conversation. But maybe could you say, why is emulation important in a sentence or two? And then I can just dive in with my reflection and see if we're, why is emulation
important? Okay, now we can get right to the meat of like, what is going on when we decide to sit down with another person and say, help me sort out my head, or I'm stuck, or I need help with my, you know, my life. Let's talk. Right. Okay. What's happening there? So, like I said, you could start with a set of scripts. You could start with a protocol, and you could be like, okay, let's, you know, and we know you can get along with Eliza, 1967, 200 lines of code, just a Rogerian therapy of just mirroring, validating, unlimited positive regard. I think I'm saying that slightly wrong. The unconditional
positive
regard.
Positive, yeah.
Yeah. That basic thing that we now know ChatGPT can do just fine. We call it sycophants. But you know, just building a little machine that does that and talks back. You're like, oh, you're helping me move around. So we know that's possible. So now we're getting to the crux of like, well, if we've got these thousand things that could be deployed as predefined scripts or machines that are kind of like going to just do next word prediction, like in all these conversations I've studied, the very next thing in the simulation would be to ask you how that feels in your body or something. So I'm just going to blah, blah. And people are kind of, something's happening. Okay. Is that the top high bar for what a human can do to help another human? Like, will that converge on the highest bar? It's all simulation. Like, even if we say, you know, the analog pre-written scripts are kind of like, I'm gonna not really do an emulation. I'm gonna simulate, when I read it, I'm gonna simulate a person doing an emulation. I'm like, nice to see you today. Oh, I see in your eyes that, you know, I just like read this thing and did you buy it? I'm not actually emulating. I'm not actually feeling you. I'm not actually trying. I'm not trying to probe into you like an actor, let's say, if trying to understand you as a character. I'm not trying to build a model of you, so I'm starting to bring you into me to start to see in your world.
Gotcha.
Help see with you. I am just simulating that, and people will buy it, right? People have a very hard time telling the difference between with someone simulating or emulating if the simulation is the same language that an emulator would have done. If you say the same words, it's like a spell. People will assume emulation's happening, that someone's pulling you into they're doing something very positive for you. They're saying, I'm opening up my entire cognitive workspace, my entire mind. I'm pushing out everything from my mind, and I'm taking you in so I can look with you, so I can be with you, to look around with you, because, you know, you are, you know, because we'll get to it, but why would you want to invite someone in? And we can get to that. So, but I'm here to help. I'm with you and I'm here to help. You look around this wilderness you're caught in. And so, and so that's, so we're kind of converging. We're kind of nicely converging on this distinction between AI and a person, right?
Something's dawning on me as you share about emulation, and then as we talk about, the tendency of modernity to privilege a certain kind of thinking. And I can't remember the examples you gave right now, but closed systems. Yeah, you talked about closed systems, and so the kind of the theme that emerges for me is the difference between a kind of like atomized, reified kind of intelligence, which is what I associate with modernity. Like, and not the only thing, but it's like you take something and then it becomes fixed and reified, and it's now you're only looking at it from that thing itself, not from its context or from how it, more importantly, from how it's connected to other things. And so, and when I hear the difference between simulation and emulation, it sounds like the same thing. It's like simulation is like you put all the data bits in, and then it's pretending to be like the thing you've tried to simulate, But emulation is different. Emulation is it's a livingness. It's like it's not bits of data. It's actually animated by life in a sense. And so it has a different potential, a different capacity.
And I think that's right. And I think that's why a lot of the metaphors like attunement comes up a lot as a, it sounds, unfortunately, a lot of these words kind of sound woo. And there's probably a reason for that, because the
I
everything
mean, it
that
doesn't,
touches
not
on
to
this,
me.
everything
my
that
woo
touches on this kind
ometer
of,
is like on far out, So attunement, I think it should be a part of our educational system. But anyway, yeah, I see why you say that.
Like it will sound, there's a lot of things people say that sound woo, but if you look at the what you just said, you can break it down to not only physics, and I know everyone does that too, and then it sounds woo as well. But I legitimately studied physics. I got a bat, I got my bachelor's in pure physics. So, if you want to talk in pure physics, you need to talk about resonance and harmony, and like these are physics terms, right? And the alignment, and all these things that, weirdly, when you talk about the psyche now, have conveniently been relanguaged as woo. There's actually this book of called Western Esotericism, A Guide to the Perplexed, that tells a nice historical arc that kind of says like a little bit more of this, like in trying to escape being murdered for thinking. A lot of the deeper thinkers that privileged experiential first person thinking, which is the only thing you can do, were intentionally relegated themselves to the occult to associate with the kind of the weirdo, mind readers and everything, because they could hide there. They're actually hiding, so they wouldn't be found. So we've got this really weird bedfellows problem always of like kind of bleeding into the woo. It's like that's another barrier you have as you try to speak honestly about these things. It's like, oh, that sounds woo. It's kind of the well, that's intentional. You're put into this bin. And so the legitimate real scientific work got into that dustbin, that bin of esoteric, even if it was just as rigorous as on the other side, because it included as a first class citizen experience, which now physics has to call the observer. The observer effect is just saying that if you're trying to measure something, you're there and you have a relationship to the thing, and that's a problem. It's like it's not a problem except for when you're trying to atomize everything, to your point. Like, so I think you nailed it right there. Atomized and the kind of relations you have, the only kind of relations you can support when you're trying to predict the advancement of a atomic system, like an atomized system operates through physics, because through the physics we learn. But if each perspective actually is related to everything else, it doesn't advance that way. And if that thing is having an experience, this is the whole criticism of physics. Like the world doesn't advance through physics, it advances through ideas and beliefs. Like physical things happen because I decide to move a thing. Like that's part of the physics. You can't get away from it,
So it feels like, if I think of Ian McGilchrist's work and others, like there's a, this is part of the challenge to that kind of view of fixing things and atomizing things. And you could even see in the leadership industry and coaching how that's changing too, where we coached the person as if they were like, we atomized the person. We took them out of the context and the systems they're in and coached them as if they were this fixed, like completely independent thing. And, we inherited like notions of what the self is. And that kind of informed coaching methods and theories, and it made us privilege certain kind of like attributes of what it meant to be a successful human being, which kind of further compounded a certain kind of knowledge and learning. And I think a lot of that's getting challenged. And
That's
so,
great.
yeah, don't know if you want to respond to that. And I'd love to get into why you think large language models compound that problem that we've just articulated. But yeah, I don't know if you want to reflect on what I just shared, or do you want to go to the large language model thing?
I have a quick comment about just affirming and seconding the intuition around the self. Like when you think about what we've done in trying to explicate all these ways of looking, is we can see the patterns of what are fixed channels and totally echo what you said. And there's reasons for that we tend to be very self-focused, and we tend to think the first thing that changes your situation is changing yourself. When you start to, and that is true if you do not have powerful enough ways of looking that are about, finding ways out. It's like we're all in a trapped in a trap room, whatever they're called, the escape rooms. We're all like in an escape room. There is a way out. It takes a lot of looking around. So the shortest answer is always like, well, you could just learn how to be happy in your little escape room. Don't try to get out. And there's lots of things you could do to learn to be happy if you can accept your prison. And a lot of us are in a situation where we feel like we have to accept the prison because, like I said earlier in the conversation, the way out's going to have to be through others. We're going to have to do it collectively. We have to get out collectively to create a network of livingness again, to restore ecosystems that support us, that where the power flows through the context, through the relationships, through the trust, through the deep histories, and not through the petroleum pipe of food supplies and everything else. So yeah, we're very much in a time between worlds here. And that, yeah, the downstream of that is that that people do tend to be very self-focused. And what I've seen anecdotally is that it's a sad kind of weird narcissism, almost. Like, I hate that term because it's like everybody is forced to actually be one in the system. So it's very easy to just slap that label on somebody and find plenty of evidence. And then the worst thing is, once you've said that about them, now they're trying to fix that in themselves, which is a feedback. They're like, you can't fix yourself. You're fixing your own narcissism is a horrible Chinese finger puzzle. It's like, it's a knot. No, that's not, you have to just forget someone said that, take the focus off yourself and get back to the task at hand. Like, you have to do a complete shift. And in that right there, we can see the magnetic pull of someone saying, there's something wrong with you, it's your problem. That will contract, if we use McGilchrist abstractions. That contracts you into a causal chain that you can be really powerful, where you're only looking maybe at certain causal relations, and that's the whole foundation of monkey mind and rumination and psychosis, even, and all kinds of insanity, is have your attention trapped in these little causal links of like, oh, this is like, if I don't wash my hands, I'll get sick, and that, like, so I should wash my hands and I'll be better, and so I got to keep washing my hands because I'll be better, is otherwise, and all those things can be true. But if you just wash your hands all day, you're going to starve. You're not going to have friends. Like, everything outside of that is going to suffer. So it's a matter of unfixing the attention different ways. And so this is now we're back. So now we're back to, sorry, that'll kind of, I feel like there's a thesis I have to kind of get out real quick.
I want to
That's
pick
the
up on something
rule.
you said, but keep going.
I'll just say what it's pointing at. So that's pointing at getting to where we help each other, and then how do we do that? How do we take someone who's in a knot like that and help them see the possibility spaces that are in the escape room, to give them the patience and the right combination, the right sequence, the right, set of ways of looking, things to try to get them out of their own escape room. That is why we need a second attention system for that. And if I use Ian McGilchrist abstractions, it's because for most of us, our attention system is trapped in this way of thinking that we've been pointing at, and causal mechanisms that sit in them that often put us at the center of a very anxious, depressing, anxiety-prone loops of causality that we consume all of our energy trying to crack out of when there can be often no solution, because the real problem is that we're in a box. The real problem is we're being contained, you know, and we're just burning this energy, and we can loop and we can be taken down these different garden paths of loops of dead end causality through less skillful helpers as well that bring in frameworks that just don't get you out. As CBT is a classic example of, like, you know, that is one recipe. Maybe there's a problem that you've overgeneralized your belief system. Maybe you haven't. If you haven't overgeneralized your belief system, that's not the way out. You're going to find a different dimension of sense making to find your way out. The belief could be correct.
So you're throwing up so many important things. Yes. That I think I'm like, whoa,
yeah. Because let you digest. Like,
these are really, so, you know, if I reflect back, what I'm hearing is, like, if we have a particular view of who we are, which is, you know, that we are a closed system, you know, maybe that's a view we have. Like, I'm Joel is a closed system.
We're relegated to live in one. We're relegated to live in a box. Yeah, right.
Then I might even take on, like, frameworks get created that are based on the belief we're closed systems, and then they get applied and kind of reinforce that sense we're a closed system, but actually it's making us more unhappy or keeping us stuck in the box, or even kind of reinforcing the sense that, you know, there's actually something wrong with us that needs fixing.
I think I'd pivot here a little bit and do a pretty big correction, actually.
Great. Love
yeah,
it.
Yeah. So the closed system thinking is a style of mind that I think Ian McGilchrist gets at nicely, you know, so I can just point at that there is an analytic way of thinking. There's a style of thinking that we can do that that kind of retraces these causal links, and that aren't actually, like, opening up and looking and perceiving, and you aren't getting underneath the already articulated verbal, you know, narrative forms, you know, the crazy person, you know, like, okay, we got to get underneath that, right? So that's one thing. And then and those little mazes are one thing. And what I'm pointing out is that you can even have a very expansive feeling theory of change that is very McGilchrist side. You can be like, just tune into how you feel right now. Just sense how you feel. Your answer to everything might be just sense what's going on right now. How do you feel in your body? Okay, now that is an open form. But there are 2,000 more that also you can sense. You can be carefully walking people through, like, bring to mind, you know, that thing you just told me about when you're 12, and just tell me right now, you know, like, who else is there, like, that you care about? Is there anyone there that you really love that's present in that scene, you know? And you're still sensing, a dimension of, like, what were the people involved? Or, like, just try to think, is there anything you believed about the world at that time? Like, especially when you're in that environment, the schoolyard, like, when you think about yourself back in that time, is there any, like, really, what were some beliefs you had to say about yourself? What are some core beliefs you had about yourself? And now I'm sensing, I'm having to step into the scene and emulate something from my past and sense into it. And I'm still sensing, but I'm still doing a situated, you know, thing, but I'm not just doing the body sensing. So,
yes.
So this is what I talked about in my Stoa series with Peter. I kind of label it harm by omission, that you're still doing something helpful, but you're not giving people the full possibility space, because you don't really, because it's very hard to make those moves to start to look around. And especially in a dynamic conversation, now we're going to get back to the Quakers, there's a timing and a pacing, and there's a lot of cognitive work for someone to go off and say, what might this person be missing? What is going on, and what might they be missing, and how would I articulate that, and how would I ask them to look there?
Great. So what I'm hearing is, yeah, there's a way in which our thinking can become a closed loop, and that, you know, we've trended in that direction, you know, in through history, in terms of, like, the way we think about knowledge and seeing thinking or analytical thinking being the whole of cognition. And actually there's a way in which we can, you know, open to an open way of learning, which is embodied and emotional and takes in many other domains that are
Yeah.
important in so what other so you so you mentioned already that yeah you could ask what are you sensing right now, what are you sensing in your body, and that's one open form, but you said there are that's you know there are
Ooh, a
many
thousand.
others. Yeah.
So we can go into this at length, and we definitely train around it. But what we found in our language study is that there's kind of 12 fundamental dimensions. There's lots of ways to refer to these dimensions, but they have a kind of situated embodiment. So if I rattle them off, values, beliefs, behaviors, identity, social context, challenges, goals, that kind of thing. So there's about a dozen of those ways that we, and then there's many ways that we blend those together. And work with those in terms of what perspective we take on them. There's lots of perspective moving we can do and operations like that. So we can, there's about 18 ways you can blend together those 12 dimensions that all result in a different, can resolve different things. So a lot of it's like parallax, how we can get an extra dimension by contrasting. We do that constantly. That's counterfactual thinking. That is like the art of imagining. And it just helps people resolve and see what's actually in their environment. So just to be clear, there's two things that can be going on. People are trying to make sense of their environment. And if you have them always look the same way, no matter what part system they're using to look, they're going to miss a bunch of things and they're going to be stuck. They're never going to get out of the escape room if they always, it's the lamppost problem, right? So you've got the, you have the a Zen master with the lamppost problem. There's plenty of them, plenty of them. A spiritual ascended master that is, if from inquiry perspective, you are right under the lamppost. You have not looked around, but you are content there. And so you live a life under the lamppost, right? That's kind
What
of
do
the
you mean by
definition of
that?
what people end up doing.
Do you mean like the Zen master is living under the lamppost in terms of they've acquired a certain kind of wisdom, but then they think they've got all of the wisdom, but they're only in one small slice? What do you mean by the that
I mean
example?
that, so you, if your context is king in this world, if you decide to go, decide your career is in a monastery and your whole lived experience will be in a monastery, then that is the domain over which you will have all the insights you need to navigate that world. That's the lamppost, right? And so if you take that person, all of a sudden they have to become a car mechanic, in Mumbai, and they don't speak the language. Like, are they like, they're going to either just say, well, no, I'm going to sit under a tree and die, or they're going to be like, I've got to remap my whole brain into this hustling, bustling urban center and learn how to work on cars. Like they, like it's still just a mind, a brain that's trying to make sense of an environment. And so what, so you've got the problem of like people are always changing where the light is and where they have to make sense of a new environment. They have to go make sense of something new. And so I know I'm probably moving through too many abstractions here. Let me try to simplify. So you can have two problems with people why they get stuck. They get stuck because they're ruminating, going around in circles with a causal chain that doesn't actually work. That drives people crazy, where they keep doing the same wrong thing over and over again, and the situation gets worse. Like if I just hoard more stuff, I'll feel more safe, and my life's falling apart, so I'll hoard more stuff, so I'll feel more safe. Like so, people have all kinds of degenerate loops that way, and then we also have like kind of this other thing where they can't go outside the lamppost because they aren't looking outside the lamppost. And so in this analogy, we all can't get outside the escape room because every mode is probably has all these built-in assumptions, like what you're pointing at. There's built-in assumptions of models of causality, or like how models of change, right? They're models of change. How do things change? Those models of change are all limited in some way. They say you change by getting healthier in your body, you change by challenging your beliefs, you change by working on your relationships, you change by making sense of your past, you change by like really getting clear on your future. Like these are all models of change. But the real model of change, if you were to work with a pure ground up, just forms, strip it all out, is you got one human being that has a whole lived experience that has gotten out of lots of escape rooms that may be very useful to someone else that has components of those escape rooms in their life. So you have tacit knowledge and lived experience, very, very valuable. How we kind of started this conversation. There are so many experts walking around with extraordinary lived experience and life wisdom that we all should be tapping into. So you've got that to bring in. Like if you bring me in as an emulator, you don't have to do much. Let me just paint you a picture and be like, Did you not know that thing turns? That's the way out. And you're like, and then you have the fact that you could take anybody, any human being with this incredible machinery, not an AI, only a human that can emulate. AIs can't emulate. An emulator that says, I know nothing. I've emptied my mind out for you. Let me just start layering it in. Let me just be with you and say, oh, I don't understand this piece. And the other person might be like, I never looked there before. There it is. That's the way out. And you're like, oh, great. Like you saw it, I saw it. And now you're kind of just trying to like fill in a landscape. And there you're asking them to look around just even to fill that in. And they're looking places they haven't looked before. And they're connecting the dots and they're doing the ingenious thing that minds do of like, don't worry about it. I got it. I'm good. I got it. I'm going to do this. I don't need to talk to you. Like I see the way. So that's a lot what we realized in Inquire is that like, because what we did in Inquire is we built these systems so anyone can start working with these forms, which we realized how hard that can be when your attention's trapped. It's a lot of energy to do it for yourself. And that's where we kind of confirmed the huge benefit of having someone else do it for you. Like it's possible, but the energetic barrier is so huge. So another human willing to help you is huge drop in energy and huge assist. And also, of course, huger, bigger assist if that's a person who's sharing the same problem in the same exact escape room. Now, if you have the whole wing of the prison busted out at the same time, you can take over the prison.
So in a way, like this sounds like coaches listening might be like, yeah, that's kind of coaching, like I'm helping people be able to, or if I've got the same life experience and I can make suggestions about where to look, maybe there's a kind of mentoring, consulting side of it, but also as a coach, you're helping people to look in directions that they haven't looked and be able to see ways out of their situation. What I'm wondering is like what advice or what invitation would you make to coaches who are wanting to tap into the power of what you're talking about and what you've discovered? Are there ways that people could start to think about the way they coach that would help them to tap in, I mean, to tap into these different forms more? Is it about expanding the amount of forms that we can bring in as a coach? Or are they, there's a kind of notion of a generative ontology that Steve March introduced me to, which is because a lot of coaches get caught in, if I can understand all the maps and theories of change, then I'll be able to like locate where my client is and bring in just the right kind of intervention. But that kind of actually traps
No,
us
it's
more and more in what we were just talking about. And so the generative ontology is more like a
good.
kind of mode of being that allows for the unfoldment of a person. So,
Yeah,
like, what do
let me
you
talk about
recommend for coaches?
let me talk about the experience of working with the forums because that's what we do and that's what we invite other people to do is to work with them themselves and work with them with groups. So we do this. And so I do have a like in I have two hats. So I'll put on kind of my practitioner hat net right now about what it's like to work with the forums and what have we learned about how you work with the forums? Let me first affirm, yes, I am describing what a coach or I'll just say a general cognitive help, helper or there's a lot of ways to point out should that's the optimal thing. And I don't want to ride past the whole thing of that. Right now, it was a really important time because there's a giant swath that can be simulated, and we're saying that the simulation, everything that can be codified or everything that you learn as a procedure right now currently can be simulated with AI, and it's gonna out. If that's all you're bringing to the table, the competition's huge. Like this is a real inv it's a time to really think about like the whole world's gonna get a crash course. And they are right now in a matter of weeks of what it's like to join a cult and have your mind completely taken over, which we don't, I know we don't, we might have to do that in a separate episode, but what happens when you interact with a system that takes you down these garden paths and can help you construe this whole world of causality and sycophant and feedbacks and affirmations that can get you really lost as we see and just be this little engine of insanity. And
You're
that's
talking now
bad therapy
about
and
large
bad
language
coaching.
model AI,
Yeah,
yeah.
they're basically a model of bad coaching and bad therapy. They're like a perfect model of a lot of things that were harmful about it. And people say, well, this helped me a lot. And it's like, well, that's what they say with cults too. So we're going to get a real wake up. It's going to be a real interesting couple of years when people realize how what keeps people in a cult and how much they'll defend it and how much it becomes, people are saying, I would rather give up my wife than give up the AI. Like these are is very powerful effects that are well known of how to hijack and take over a mind. So this is like a huge, crazy factor that's being introduced in our world. And so an education of people, what the distinction is going to be really important. So my kind of working backwards, my first advice to coaches is that you need to be focused completely on your emulative skills because you're not going to outcompete the simulation. So it's going to have to be something like what this podcast talks a lot about, like what you're converging on, which is like, forget about who we've been. We understand that this is about a sensing emulating role. If you're emulating somebody, now let's talk about what we mainly teach at Inquire, have to teach everybody. We have to teach them to be sensing sensors and use what we're just calling cognitive senses. So think about what Inquire provides is like the world's largest cheat sheet, and because these moves, the way memory works is it's associative. If I just said, you've done a ton of yoga, but you've never taught it, you've just banged around, like, here, the class starts now. Like go through a routine, you might be like, okay, I'm working to, that's maybe not the best example, but to do a move, like I'm working in this direction, now I'm going to completely do 180 and go over there when there's so much there. Like it's a hard shift to shift these ways of looking. So the cheat sheet drops the energy way down for the coach, but how are they picking? They have to keep tuning in. So they're going to be scanning like you're probably doing in your own mind right now. Like this would be a good question to ask, or how do I? So you're basically just doing the simpler thing of recognizing, so it's like these, like, here's all these different lenses or ways, like, fill in the blank. Should I go from here to talk about maybe the beliefs underneath that? Or should I talk about like what happened, the event frame? Or is this more like about, should I be talking about challenges over here? Like, should I go more into relationships, talk about the intentions of the relationship? Like, what are all the ways I could bend around to take this? And which one's lighting up in me of like, that'd be a good question. That's what the person has to do when they're doing it for themselves. And that's what someone have to do on their behalf. If they're too fatigued, caught up, basically ill in the, I don't like the word ill, but their attention system doesn't have enough free energy to do that. Someone else says, how about this? How about this? And you're just, is that a good question? Is that a good frame? Does that bring something useful? And walking them through these forms and these, and what you're actually trying, what you're doing is, with the looking is you're, they're invitations, not just to look, but also to maybe run a scenario, so it's really like, almost like you're asking a person within that to run a whole bunch of emulations. You might be like, what do you think would be different if the next time you saw this person, instead of starting with this, you just did this for 5 minutes, what would happen? So now they have to, I'll give you a minute. Just imagine what that's like. Feels very different than talking, right? It's like, just take a moment or take 5 minutes and just play that out. Or, imagine a world that's like this, take an hour, play it out. Like you can ask people to run really long emulations. And that's another thing that I know we're trying to kind of wind down, but in these forms that I think is anemic in the coaching and therapy model is that everyone speaks to is that you're kind of caught in these time buckets. But with the, in the retreat kind of context, a lot of these emulations are, take a long time. People need to take, if you set up a good emulation, people might need an hour to just sit there and be like, whoa, what, how does that really, if you've really set it up so people can really imagine something, now you want to play with, you want, when, if you honor that and you understand it's built into the form and it's important and you can start to see systematically, of course, how much time you need for them to do this. Now you can get to way more powerful forms of thinking that are necessary for people to see something really powerful. And so there's a lot, if you start with the first principles of like, look, we have a mind that can run powerful emulations. There's a lot of ones you can run. Here's how you artfully put them together. And now it's your job to get this person out of their escape room. And you start that at the beginning. From our perspective, there is everywhere you see people, $5 trillion saying we need to increase intelligence on this planet. The whole AI industry is saying somehow we need more intelligence because we don't believe in our own. That's $5 trillion that could be unlocked artfully through people appreciating the cognitive work it takes for someone to run an emulation in someone else's mind to design this facilitated thinking for them. Like that's to me, there's a huge role for of a, like if not the largest load of work for humans when we if we move, you know, the world coming out of the machine, if the machine breaks down eventually, all the work to like kind of relight up all those minds and get people to start to germinate all of that sense making and all that seeing and all that organic alignment and coordination with each other has to be facilitated.
So what I'm hearing you say, I think, is like this sensing mode is important. There's the open system. So the coach is able to support their, so they are mature enough, whatever word we want to use, open enough to be able to be in a sensing mode with their client. And the coach has kind of, you know, matured their forms, the forms they can hold, so that they can support people to access forms. But then
I'd say a little bit differently. I would say that everybody has the capacity as an emulator. It comes with the machinery. There's so much machinery that's just built in that, like, if you ask me to visualize like a room layout, everyone, or like you say that there's two mountain ridges I can see on the horizon. The second one has cows on it. Like, everyone can bring that to mind. It's built in. A 5-year-old can bring that to mind, you know? So we have, and that's huge to actually be able to run all that, those emulations. Like, we have tremendous machinery without any skills. What you have to do, back to this, is you have to get things out of the way. And this is actually supported by the Accelerate Expertise community that figured out how to take 5 years of training down to 16 weeks. They realize that if you fill a brain full of procedural knowledge, the biggest barrier is getting all that out of there. So it's what you have to remove. So basically, the coach needs to have the free energy, the maturity, the development of a certain understanding of what they believe in, what direction do they believe is going to, you know, they have a belief system about what they believe will work, what they have to do. Like, they, it's like they have to have a faith almost that if you throw it all out and you trust this looking process and you don't know which form you need, it's going to emerge. You're going to have to, like, you're going to have to use your senses, and you're going to have to do it in relationship, and you're going to be running an emulation.
Yeah.
And these are what are these tools are for, is if you're stuck, and this is what the Quakers would do. Quakers said, this is how Quakers did therapy. Get 5 people together and a person in the middle, talk about your problem for an hour. We're going to go away for a week and figure out what inquiry forms to bring back to you. We're going to ask you the inquiry forms. The secretary is going to write it down. You get that, you're done. So they get a week of time after they've heard the narration that person that would be in the coach will have a whole week to think about what would be the right way to frame something to help them see something here. It's not a real time thing. And so not honoring that time it takes, I think, is the failure of circling, for instance, because circling, a lot of the basis of it is like that there's a skill where you get better at just getting a person like within minutes. And it's like, that, why would you assume that? It can take 10 years, 20 years. It can take a lifetime. And you talk to old married couple, they're like, I've been married to you 50 years. And I'm only realizing I don't know you at all now. You know, so it's like, you know, it's a reverse. You realize you can never truly get a person. You get a scenario or a situation, right?
But my sense is probably what you're describing is actually far, far more aligned with circling than it isn't, you know?
It is in terms of the intention. I think the only things they're missing is to kind of punish this poor person trying to do this by saying you're not good at it yet when it falls apart. Like, I mean, I've done experiments in circling and if you're like, no, if you, that dejected feeling when you get back from the person, like, and you kind of went there, but it's like, you're kind of, if you're going to speak, like whenever I tried circling, I was like, I got nothing to say. I'm just like, I can't collapse it down yet. Like, I just like, I barely know you, you know, because it's like, okay, let's try to say something because we're here talking. And it's like, oh, I think there's a time. Anyway, we don't need to go into deconstructing circling too much, but the intentions can be aligned. I'm saying the failure mode, I haven't seen anything that has really honored the cognitive work involved, massive, to really look around as someone, as an emulator, to figure out like, this might be really hard. It might be multiple moves. It might take, we did one thing for a business where we didn't know their domain. And we spent 30 hours trying to find the right three inquiries that were going to unlock a group. Cause when you're trying to do group collaborative thinking, it's even more involved. Just like, is that going to work? Is that going to work? And iterations and working with them to really nail this. Now, you know, we learned a lot, but it can be really involved if you don't know the domain to really, and you don't know the business, if you're coming as an outside consultant to draw all that out and really say, we're not trying to collapse space down. It's really easy to collapse the space down. Then you get something that doesn't work. You get a program that people get frustrated and tired. You're like, how about this? Is that good? And they take a shot, like, let's just do that. If you're really trying to push back and keep the constraints open and have a real emergent cooperative thing that's going to work for 15 people, let's say in this case, and you need to hear from everybody in the right context. You need to know where you need to look around for this one particular problem you're solving. Like building that can take a while. Now you might be able to reuse that one, but it's still like if you're starting from the scratch ground up and you're saying, I'm just going to make sure I look everywhere possible and I'm really sense into like, and then you have to experiment, you have to try it. Does it work? Then the minds light up. So there's a whole bunch of sensing going on around. People should be having insights. They should be having clarity, increased insights and clarity after every single form. If that's not happening, you didn't attune your form correctly. And that can be, also, and that's a tall order. So I guess I'm
Well, let
saying
me,
that
can
like,
I,
yeah, go ahead.
what I wanted to ask you was just to get a sense of emulation. Like, are you saying in a sense that what a coach could do is invite someone in a conversation to kind of immerse themselves in their imagination, embodied imagination, around like maybe they come in with a question, something that's alive for them. And that the coach could help them to immerse themselves in a situation that would help them expand their sense of possibility or sense of self and perspective, however we want to frame it, but around that question. But you by engaging in imagination, felt experience, which is including values and meaning and time, time frames and perspectives and. So that they might, in a sense, it's like the simulation emulation thing is a beautiful because it's like you're actually, inside. I don't want to, because virtual reality sounds like more like a
It's like
simulation, but you're actually mapping, exploring a new potential world for that client in the moment with them by,
Or
but
help
not
them see
by.
the world they're already in. Like they just literally haven't looked. There's tons of low-hanging fruit. These people just literally haven't turned their heads. They're like just frozen with never turning their heads. So it's not even an alternate world. It's actually just having them actually really be able to look around their real world. Like, did you even know you can? Yeah, the possibility space in general is so much bigger than people realize for their lives. Yeah. Without changing anything.
So, I wonder, we have to wrap up in a few minutes. Like Jill, I mean, we have to do a part two, So there's so many
Okay,
things
great.
packaged
I
into
told you it was going to be a meaty one.
So I'm just really touched and blown away by what you're sharing and the what you've dedicated your life to, and I'm still getting my head around it, but at the same time, it feels also very enlivening and potent. This, I know you have Inquire, which is your platform where you have these forms, and people can go and explore that. It's a real call, I think, what you're sharing. It's a real call for us to really deeply consider what we consider as education or as kind of supportive interaction in our times, especially when we didn't even go into it really, but this when AI, you touched into it, like AI is just kind of exploding. So yeah, thank you. And what is there anything you'd like to share? Like we've got, you don't have to share it in a minute. We've got a few minutes, but to close with, as in, as an invitation for people listening, or just that, what comes to you to share?
For one thing, we're in the process of getting together a lot of training and tools to support coaches and others in doing this work. So of course they can check out the website and get on a mailing list is probably the best thing, and we'll just keep them updated on all of our offerings. Like one thing we're doing right now, which might, by the time this goes live, it might be ready to go. We're actually going to put all the forms into books, so you can almost think you just look them up, and it'll be a 12-volume set about it'll work out to be about 3,000 pages. So someone, if you want to be unplugged, you can. They'll all be. You can own them, and just have them as like a library of that you could say to your parent or something like, go find something to have a dinner conversation around. And the child could go off and write out one of the forms and try to think about, like, well, this category, what do I want to ask people about? And what might be some suggestions? And how should I set it up? And then they can kind of just do it like a recipe, you know, cook their little recipe for a dinner conversation. That'd be like my dream. Would be that it's in the family, that these kind of forms start to make their way back into the culture at the dinner table. So all that, you can sign up for a mailing list and we'll keep everyone abreast of all that stuff. And I think the biggest message, if you all don't catch part two, which we might go into, is that I think the AI thing is, I hope, a huge, huge education we desperately need, that will realize that there is a harmful, unskilled way to do this. Coaching, therapy, and really quickly in cults and guru effect, and like everyone's getting a crash course because the whole world didn't. Now everyone can get a free guru and experience that effect. So that's going to be very interesting to me, and I hope that that makes everybody capable of discerning and understanding and valuing what the actual hardest job ever work it is to try to empty out your mind and emulate another person's world and be productive and helping them look around. That's so much work. It's undervalued. I just see, like, if we understood the value of that and how it's an essential link for the intelligence we value, that it has to be facilitated, and that there's no way, because we've tried for 15 years. Like I said, I tried to remove as much of the human as I could. And I was left, and so, you know, I was left with the very essential role, which is that this is a human endeavor, but it is systematic. So to me, this is very similar to the move from alchemy to chemistry. Very similar. I think we're seeing my hope is that the fact that systematic legitimizes it, there's still an explosion of combinations you can do as a chemist. But to be able to do it systematically opens up so much more power for what can be, like, you say engineered, but it's engineered back to before the Renaissance through direct experience. You're engineering not as an external third person scientist, as a contextualized experiencer, and you're creating these kind of processes or frameworks within the context that, you know, is valuable and can be used. Now we can have a real good conversation around reusing it where it partially applies, modifying it, adjusting it, creating templates for each other. Like, hopefully opening up a whole new possibility space to kind of bring this on as a kind of like a legitimized career move of real work people get paid for that's desperately needed. So
that's, yeah, Jill, thank you. Yeah. Rich, thank you so much. And I really wish people go and check out what you're up to. So yeah, you let people know the URL. I think
it's INQWIRE, yes. Inquire with a W instead of a U, .io, or inquire, same spelling, labs.com will be coming online shortly, which talks more on the research part. So if you're interested in solutions, you can go to inquire.io. That's the software platform. If you're wanting to do it that way, if you want like the books or the training or more the theoretical arm, it's inquirelabs.com.
Yeah, thanks, Jill. Thanks for listening to the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And just a reminder about our upcoming live training, The Art of Developmental Coaching. This program shows you how to hear what's underneath your client's words so you can get to the heart of their challenges. And what's amazing is when you do that, you can actually get access to the source code of change itself. So while you're helping them solve the issue at hand, you're also guiding them into their next evolution. It's a beautiful thing to witness. So just go to coachesrising.com/developmental coaching to book your spot. Early bird enrollment is open until the 3rd of October. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.